Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kaiser Forum, which we're running today in partnership with Frontline. I'm Penny Duckham, and I run the Kaiser Health Journalism Programs, and I'm delighted that you can join us today. This is timed, as I think you know, to a documentary which is going to air this evening on Frontline, 9 o'clock, I think, on PBS here and at other times across the country. This is a new film, Sick Around the World, which has been produced by T.R. Reid from the Washington Post, who's been a Kaiser Fellow this last year and used much of his fellowship time to do some of the research on the project. If only all our fellows were quite as productive, we would have a different world of journalism. I'm delighted just to introduce the program today. We're joined, fortunately, today not just by T.R. Reid from the Washington Post, who you may already know. His voice is very familiar from NPR. And, of course, you know him from the Washington Post. We're also being joined by Tsung-Mei Cheng from Princeton University's International Center, and you'll see shortly that she was a great expert resource for the film and also to the Taiwanese government in their reform of their healthcare system, and by Professor Uwe Reinhardt, who you probably need no introduction to, the James Madison Professor of Political Economy at Princeton University, who, of course, is a world expert as well on global healthcare schemes. Jackie Judd, my colleague, the Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation for Communications, will be moderating the session. We're hoping to show a short clip from the film to entice you to watch either online or tonight, and then we're going to move to a discussion which Jackie will moderate, followed by lots of questions, we hope, from you. So I'm going to hand this over now to TR.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming on Income Tax Day. We appreciate it. I think I'm obliged to say that I'm not an expert on health policy, but I play one on TV, or at least tonight I get to play one on TV. I set out about 18 months ago to write a book about how other rich countries do health care, what we can learn from them. And as you all know, God, it's huge. I mean, it's just a massive hole. It's completely lost on it. And I just had the good fortune to be at Princeton in the fall term, and I walked down to the Woodrow Wilson School and signed up for a course called The Political Economy of Healthcare Systems, taught by the great Professor Uwe Reinhardt. And this is literally true. After 4 months in that course, I went into New York and said to my editor, here's the book. I've got it figured out. And one of the reasons I figured it out was every single day in Professor Reinhardt's class, he would say, now, this is difficult to understand, but my wife explains it this way. And so the other expert was also my guru. And then along the way, we've turned turned part of this book into a film, and we're going to see part of the film now. So please enjoy it. And let's roll them.
Great job. Thank you all for joining us. And as you know, one thing that we want to explore today is what can we, the United States, learn from Taiwan and the four other countries that are featured in this documentary. And whenever there is a discussion like that, it always comes around to this comment, well, that's socialized medicine, and we can't do that in the United States. Towards the end of the documentary, Tom, you said, what I found was it's not all socialized medicine out there. Did you go in believing something different?
Well, I had taken a great course, so I knew. But most Americans really believe in this notion that if it's not in our country, it's government-run socialized medicine. God, you just hear that all the time. What we found is countries using the Bismarck model, the German model, it's like Germany, France, Netherlands, Switzerland, Japan, they have universal coverage with private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance, and they spend a heck of a lot less than we do. So you can definitely do this in the private sector. Excuse me, that's my phone.
All phones off, please, including those on the stage.
Yeah, so it doesn't have to be socialized medicine. There are some rules you have to follow, and there's some regulation, but no, the private sector can handle this. We've just screwed it up here.
Does it stop the debate in its tracks, though, Tom, when we raise the S word?
Well, that's what the AMA found. I think they had a PR guy invented the term socialized medicine in the 40s when they were fighting the Truman Universal Health Care Plan. And, yeah, that's kind of the killer argument. May I just say that the other countries pay back the compliment. Now, if you go to Prime Minister's questions in the British Parliament, and the Tories stand up and denounce Gordon Brown and Tony Blair because people are waiting hours, months in my constituency for care, the answer always is, well, the honorable gentleman opposite obviously wants to install American-style for-profit medicine here, and this we will never do. And that's the killer argument over there. We don't want to be like America. So, geez, my phone, I'm sorry.
May.
So, yeah, that's a killer argument. But I don't think it's a legitimate argument because so many countries are doing health care in the private sector.
May, towards the end of the segment that we just saw, you alluded to the financial challenges that this new program was facing. Since this was shot, what's happened? Have the worst fears been realized?
Can you explain what do you mean by worst fears?
Well, when this was implemented, there were concerns that it was going to bust the budget.
I actually have a little slide which I like to share with you all that shows the financial impact of the introduction of the national health insurance in Taiwan, what it did. This is the slide. We look at three things: national health expenditure as a percent of GDP, rate of growth of national health expenditure, and the third line is population insured. So you can see in the first column, in the pre-NHI days, in the population insured, there's only 57% people covered, which means 41% of the people had no insurance. But as soon as the national health insurance was introduced, overnight, they brought in some 40% of the population without insurance. And today, it's full universal national health insurance. The reason why it's 99 plus is prison population is not in there. They have their prison health care. And so then we look at national health expenditure as a percent of GDP. In the pre-NHI days, the three-year average, they were spending 4.8% a year, a GDP on health care. And then, of course, in the year that the program was introduced in 1995, there was a one-time big jump to 5 to 9. But then you can see in 2005, that is a significant figure. It's only 6.16%. So the growth over this 13-year period has been less than 1.5% GDP. And yet, population-wise, they have gone from covering 57% to universal national coverage. And then what happened to the spending growth? The national health insurance is also turns out to be a really, really good cost control measure. So in the three-year average, the growth rate in the 3 years before the NHI was around 14%. Some scholars would say 16%. And then, of course, a one-time jump in that 1 year because you brought in 41% of the additional population. And this is a truly significant number. 2005, the growth rate of national health expenditure was contained at 3.37%. So the interesting question is, what would the growth rate have been had Taiwan not introduced national health insurance? But then, this is the financial impact. The lesson is that it did not bankrupt the country.
You know, between what you said and what TR said in his narration, as an American audience, you think, this just sounds too good to be true. How could it be?
But it is true. What can I say? The numbers speak for themselves.
You also, in addition to participating in this, you also wrote an article in Health Affairs about the program in Taiwan. And you said, one might criticize Taiwan for having ushered in its NHI with undue haste. What I'm wondering is, was speed actually its ally? Because it moved so quickly, there wasn't an opportunity to get bogged down in the politics.
I think this is a really important question. Taiwan implemented its national health insurance in 1995, 5 years ahead of schedule, because the original plan was that it should be brought in the year 2000. But then the president and the premier decided, well, let's do it. You know, why not? We have the money to do it. Let's do it. Yes, it was heavily criticized, and there were a lot of skeptics who say this thing is going to fail. But then, so satisfaction at the very beginning of the introduction, which was in March 1995, was around 30%. But by the end of the year, satisfaction already went up to 60%. And it's been in the 70s ever since then, except for one-time dip when they increased the premium. But that's another story. So they introduced it 5 years ahead of schedule. But then I think we all remember what happened in 1997, 98, the Asian financial crisis struck. It hit the Asian countries, some of them really, really hard. Now, Taiwan was spared the disaster that struck Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand, but the growth rate nevertheless went down. And it has never been as good since the years before the NHI was introduced. So, and in fact, in 2001 or 2, Taiwan had a negative growth rate. So if say by the year 1999, 2000, they're still debating, shall we put this thing out next year in 2000? Many might say, no, we can't afford it. Where are we going to find the money? So in this respect, yes, it was. They were very, very lucky. But also, I think what mattered was leadership. The president saw the opportunity, the window of opportunity that he had then, that the people wanted it, the economic conditions were right. And then he provided leadership, and so this thing got up, and it's now in its 13th year, and people, it is said that it is the guardian angel of social peace in Taiwan.
The politics are interesting in Taiwan because, you know, it was their Democratic Party, the lefty party, that kept saying we need universal health care. And the Republican or the conservative president saw that and said, let's do it before they do. And that was one of the reasons for the leadership. But you could, maybe some Republican in America would decide he better do this before the Democrats take it away from him.
I want to move on to Uwe in a moment, but May, before we leave you, I have to ask one question. What is said in the little chat that the government official has with the frequent visitor? What happens?
Well, you just get a little chat, the friendly chat at that, because the NHI IT system picks you up, right? So, you went to see the doctor 21 times in the last month, and so you're considered an outlier case. So then, the NHI official, I'll go pay you a visit or I call you. They say, that this was the case. Is there anything wrong? Is there anything else we can do? Because maybe it's not all medical. So they will try to get to the bottom of the problem and try to help people. Because in many cases, people needed the counseling type of help.
I see.
But as a result of this kind of identifying the high users, that they and going to visit them for the chat, they were able to reduce the utilization by an average of 30% to 60%.
So by those people.
By those people. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's very significant.
Effective. We began the conversation with Tom and talking about the terms of the debate. Uwe, I've heard you say in some of your speeches that dignity and social solidarity are not in our dictionary when we discuss health policy. It was in some of the countries that you visited. So does this debate here in the U.S. need to change, need to move more towards the kinds of things that Tom was hearing?
I think it really does. If I may add an anecdote, after the fifth year, I think, of Taiwan Health Insurance, we had a little celebration over there. I tag along with her. And we went to see the president, who was the president who introduced this bill. And he talked and he said, I now go to the farms and old people come up to me and clasp my hand and said, thank you, Mr. President. Now I can go to the doctor when I ache and I don't go broke. And that president stood there with tears in his eyes. And I said, you know, it takes a moral commitment. To him, this wasn't just a political thing. He was really morally committed to that. And recently, May and I interviewed Ulla Schmidt, the Minister of Health of Germany. And May asked her, you had only 200,000 uninsured in Germany, and yet you take such pride in having them covered now. Mm-hmm. Now it's universal. And she says, oh, it was intolerable to me that Germans should go when they're sick and be healthcare beggars. She said, it is not dignified. You lose your dignity if you're a beggar. And we said, this is the third time in this interview you use the word dignified. Mm-hmm. And that matters to these people. And I think we need to rediscover that above all, the health system of a nation is an expression of the moral values of that society. Most countries, and you will have heard this, when you interview them, as we did Ulla Schmidt, they talk about the principle of solidarity. They say, you can have competition, you can have everything, but when you're sick, we're one nation. We look after each other. And you don't hear that so much in our debate. In other countries, in Canada, Germany, Asia, they put the ethics openly on the table and then discuss it. Is that what we want? And then they design the system of it. Remember, that was also with Hong Kong. Bill Chow went over there, surveyed, what do you want? Now, you could have different. You don't have to copy their ethics, but the three distinct ethics are healthcare is a social good that should be available to everyone on equal terms when they need it. That's the Taiwan-Canada approach. The second is the European-German approach. Healthcare should be a pure social good, available to everyone who needs it on equal terms, and financed by ability to pay, except for an elite, small elite in Germany, 10, Sweden, less than 10, England, less than 10, yeah, who are allowed to buy out. Now, Bill Chow said that's a design flaw, and in some regard it is, but it's a safety valve because you want to get these malcontents out of the system. So you can have your own thing, and then for 90%, we run our show. But in Germany, once you chose private, you can't come in to the social insurance system. You left the club, you enjoy yourself. You'll never come back.
In your lifetime?
Yes, in your lifetime. That's it. You make a choice. You're either part of our society or you're not. If not, enjoy it. And that's what they do. And we need to do that here, too, and not allow people every 90 months to switch in and out of Medicare, private or public, for example. And the third one is healthcare is a private consumption good that people should be responsible for. And if they're really down on their luck, we might help them. But by and large, it's your show. And that's sort of what we are now embracing without debate, though. If you look at consumer-directed healthcare, the proposition is that healthcare should be cheaper for rich people than poorer people. That's what tax deductibility means. And that healthcare should be rationed on the basis of ability to pay. That's the proposition of consumer-directed healthcare. It's sold, of course, as if this will be nirvana in quality control and everything else. But it is an ethical proposition which is never discussed in this country. But it should be discussed up front. That's what it really does. Yeah. So that's the first lesson.
Occasionally, you will hear politicians frame it as a basic given right. Healthcare.
Occasionally, they were very few, actually. Well, if they say it, they certainly don't put the money there to mean it. And not having a social ethic, what it leads to is this mismatch we have. We expect our doctors, our nurses, our healthcare executives to be perfect egalitarians. when they deliver health care. We hold them strictly to that. What we pay is by social class. So in New Jersey, we pay a pediatrician $30 to see a Medicaid child, but $120 to see our own. So we really tell that pediatrician, your professional work is worth only a quarter of what it is worth if you do our child when you do it to a poor kid from Trenton. That's what we I told the legislators of the state of New Jersey, that's what you're communicating. I don't know if you want to communicate this, but that's what you're saying. And the docs are hearing you. Why? No pediatrician in Princeton takes Medicaid kid. They understood your signal. That is unthinkable in Canada or Germany or Taiwan.
And I think it also goes back to what the Taiwanese doctor was saying to you in what we saw, that it's not a system, it's a market.
Yeah, sure, that's how we do shoes, you know. I can't afford Manolo Blahniks.
They're not for you.
They're not for me. Well, I'm lucky. Or whatever. Or Versace underwear, say.
Not for you.
Not for me either.
TMI, too much information, as my kids would say.
But the other lesson that you learn abroad, first of all, all of us know this. You don't have to spend like we do to get good health care. Because, for instance, you saw the Swiss system.
Yeah.
They have more doctors, more hospital beds, more MRI machines, everything more than we have, and spend only 70% or so of what we spend. It's a high-quality system. One of the reasons why we spend so much, we are the world's biggest klutzes when it comes to administration. No one has the hassle. I was the other day with some insurance people. They're still on a bill, cannot identify match patient and provider. They still cannot get that done. I say, I can't believe any other country would have trouble identifying the doctor and the patient on a bill. That's why so many bills sit there so long. So, I mean, there we could learn a lot. We could learn IT from Taiwan. How do you run an IT system? England, Germany, Denmark, France. They're all surpassing us, France. We're lagging. We invent the stuff. We sell the software. They use it. We can't because we're just klutzes in not inventing it, but in using it.
Can I just ask a quick question to May? How many years did it take Taiwan to develop the smart card that everyone has now?
The planning, thinking about it, started in 1998.
Uh-huh.
Well, 1998, because they started with a paper card. Everyone was issued paper cards, which allowed you 6 visits. So after each visit, you have a seal stamped on that little box. Mm-hmm. And when the card is finished, then you have to go apply for a new one. Now, you can imagine that this is very time-consuming, very inconvenient, and very costly to the government, the cost of printing new cards. So every month, you have something like 200,000 people running around in the street just to get new cards.
You know,
and so they started thinking about it, and then they have test pilots in the offshore island of Penghu, mm-hmm. where it was highly popular. People loved it. And then by 2003, they started a dual card system. Some people got the smart card, and others are still using the paper card. And then comes January 1, 04, they rolled it out nationwide.
Yeah.
And it's been just fabulous. Mm-hmm. The savings already, this smart card already paid for itself 3 times over.
You know, I saw this in France, 61 million people, 61 million of these green cards. It's called the Carte Vitale. Germany now has the Gesundheit Card. And France, I think it really works. There's no paper anymore in France. It's all a record like we saw in that film. 61 million people, 3% administrative cost, 3% to 5% good care, the rated number one in the world. When I saw this in France, I went running into the health ministry in Paris to find the IT guy. And I said, whoa, I love that Carte Vitale. It's fantastic. Where'd you get it? He says, you know, that's a company called Baxter in St. Louis did that for
yeah.
us. It's our technology, but they were willing to do it. I just want to point out that our president has set as a national goal that America will have 50% digital records by 2014. Does it make you feel better?
Uwe?
Well, see, the other message, that two more. The one is you can use private market forces and competition. All of that these countries use. The Taiwan system is the delivery side is substantially private. Canada to Germany, almost fully private. Many hospitals for profit. You can have all of that, but you must regulate private market forces. Now, all other nations know that in healthcare. We finally are discovering it in banking, of all places, that you can't let these people run loose. Self-discipline principle, we know what it means. They go and sell interest rate swaps to school districts, and they go bankrupt. In fact, I just penned a little editorial while our men and women are fighting overseas. The bankers are busily trashing their country, which is very sad. But that's what the bankers are doing. So you need very good government regulation, but you should use private market forces, and they all do. Germany had a reform doing exactly that right now. And the final one was the one Tom already mentioned. Don't succumb to clichés. Switch on your thinking apparatus when it comes to health policy. I always hear, particularly Rudy Giuliani, called everything under the sun socialized medicine. Don't confuse social insurance with socialized medicine. They are two different things. Social insurance is, for example, what Ben Bernanke now does with the bankers and Hank Paulson. They have a risk that's private, and they roll it onto us. That's social insurance. The principle of limited liability in corporations, where the shareholder owes no more than what they paid for a share, and if the company blows up a whole village, society takes care of it. That's social insurance. I always say to sort of, when I go to these sort of conservative groups and they talk about social insurance, and I say, I hate it too. We should get rid of the principle of limited liability. Stops the discussion right there. So that's all social insurance. Another example of social insurance, when Mayor Lindsay retired, he didn't make provision in his life, as he could have, although he was a rich man, and he was going broke over medical bills. And a compassionate conservative called Rudy Giuliani gave him two fake city jobs to give him health care and a pension. And that's socialized insurance. Right, that's what that is. Yeah. So Rudy may not know this, but he ought to be taught. He should sit through my course, then he'll know. Now, socialized medicine is something else. Socialized medicine is when the government owns, finances, and operates the production facility, the British NHS, mm-hmm. Cuba. Mm-hmm. Can somebody think of another system like that?
Is it close to home?
Close to home, mm-hmm. in this town.
Mm-hmm. Medicare.
No, that's socialized insurance.
VA.
What we reserve, so I testified once, I remember, before the Veterans Committee, and I said, I'm just an immigrant, I don't understand everything too good here. Explain to me, you love your veterans and you hate socialized medicine. Why then is it that you preserve that for your veterans?
Yeah.
Why do you hate your veterans? And they were really stunned. But that's what socialized insurance, which happens to be one of the best in terms of use of IT and quality in America now.
It's often held up as a model.
As a model. So one can only just warn the people, if you hear politicians ramble on about socialized this and that, they literally know not whereof they speak. They're either mischievous or stupid. And you've got to have your choice here. But it can't be anything else. They should know better. If you have a bachelor's degree from anywhere, you should know better.
At this point, I'd like to open it up to you, the audience. I want to ask you a few favors. Wait until you have the microphone in your hand. Stand up, identify yourself, who you're affiliated with. And while we find the first person, Tom, I just want to ask you one quick question.
Yeah.
And that is, in the 9 or 10 countries that you actually explored for the documentary and the book, what worked least well? Was it the frustration of the doctors who were protesting out on the streets that they weren't paid enough? What worked less well?
Everywhere in the world, docs complain that they're not paid enough, including here. But it's probably true in Japan and arguably true in Germany. The way some of these countries get costs down is they shaft the doctors and the hospitals. That's certainly true in Japan and seems to me to be true probably in Germany. So
the story you tell
didn't
about
work very well. And then, you know, Britain, we lived in Britain. You go in a hospital in Britain and they have buckets catching the leaking from the ceiling. We used to go to the St. Mary's Hospital near Paddington Station, was our local hospital. And Fleming invented penicillin at St. Mary's Hospital in 1928. And we thought it hadn't been painted since then. You know, I mean, so there, the plant, the maintenance, just the level of facilities is not what we're used to in those countries.
Okay. A question here.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Carmen Ramos-Watson. I'm the executive director of Celebra la Vida con Salud. It's a national health education campaign, Celebrate a Healthy Life for Hispanics. And I have two questions. One for all of you. I was curious as to, in the study that you made, what is the emphasis on prevention? How much investment is made on strategies for preventing chronic disease or for preventing people to use the system in excess in terms of healthier outcomes? And the second, I was curious about the 70% consumer satisfaction that you indicated. I was curious about the 30%. What creates the dissatisfaction on the 30%?
May?
On the role of prevention in the Taiwan's NHI, they do a lot. There's free prenatal care. There's complete childhood immunization. There's adult health checks. It's free. You can, above a certain age, I think 55, you get blood pressure, cholesterol, and all that tested. And then they also do what I would call a kind of disease management program, where the payment to the provider is based on both process and outcome. And they have selected 5 diseases, asthma, tuberculosis, breast cancer, hypertension, there's one more.
Diabetes,
thank you. That's a very important one, actually. Where if the doctor is able to keep, say, your hemoglobin A1C down to the level that's considered good for a diabetic, you get points, extra payment. And for dental care, if your patient didn't develop a cavity, you get some points. So it's very thoughtful, I thought, the NHI, in terms of prevention.
If you have time to watch our movie tonight or it's going to be on the web, I think the preventive care in Britain is marvelous. Everywhere you go in Britain, there's a sign saying, are you coughing? Call this 800 number. Does your back hurt? Call this number. Is mom smoking? Call this number. We'll help her. And, of course, that's all free. Everywhere you go, and the doctor is paid by what the economists call pay for performance. If he keeps his people healthy, he can double his pay. The doctor in our movie has doubled his pay by proving that his patients are healthier than they were beforehand. And so I went to the health minister in Britain and said, whoa, this really blows me away. What good preventive care you have. Why are you doing this? He says, it's all a matter of incentive. He said, from the minute the line turned blue on your mother's pregnancy test until the day you die at age 99, you're going to be my patient. Don't you think I want to keep you healthy? Now, that's an incentive structure, whereas an American insurance company that has a guy for about 4.4 years from 32 to 36, it would be a waste of money for them to spend money to keep him healthy when he's 60. So we don't have as good an incentive structure. That's what I would say.
Did you want to jump in?
I think the latter point is the most important part of this. We now have the capability, before too long, to use genetics to figure out people's probability of getting sick 10 years, 20 years from now. And the dream about medical practitioners is to treat probabilities, to influence them, rather than just illness when it appears. But the problem is, without life cycle insurance, where you're in it, like in all these systems, no one has an incentive to actually pay for this, you know. Why should private insurance company A invest heavily in that, and then they switch to a competitor B who get the benefit of that? So we haven't figured out how to do this. Our private insurance companies in, say, Medicaid managed care, they will do good preventive care for birth, because there the payoff is very quick. It's within 9 months. If you could not only prevent a premature baby, but have it a little more weight, saves a lot of money. So they will actually do incredible things in order. But you see, to them, it's business. It's a business proposition.
And what about the flip side of that, end-of-life care? What did you find, Tom?
Well, end-of-life care is the 80-20 rule. Mm. It is true. I think everybody in this room knows that 20% of the people use 80% of the health care, and there's some strikingly large percentage of health care dollars are spent in the last 6 months of people's life or the last month. Those are really difficult personal decisions. It's somebody else's life. It's hard to say, well, you're too old to get that treatment. The place that does do it, I think, is Britain. They ration care, but they have this national public organization. It's called NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. And, of course, the tabs always say NICE kills grandma because they cut off the... But at least it's public. And when I went to NICE, they just opened their files and said, here are all our decisions on what we'll allow and what age we'll do dialysis. So they're making... Somebody's making those choices. Of course, those choices are made in America, too, but they're made in the back room of the insurance company, and they're not public. They're not equal for everybody. Everybody has to make those decisions, so I think the process of making them is what's important.
I mean, we saw yesterday's front page New York Times had an article about cost sharing,
yeah,
this tier four,
yeah,
where an insurance company now make 25 to 30% co-insurance for very high-end, often end-of-life drugs. So we're actually beginning to address the question, but we're using the market.
Yes.
For people in the top 10% of the income distribution, they pay for this. They might have to pay $2,000 a month, but if it were a waitress, she just has to die. So we do that also, but we use the market to make those decisions. In England, they use a committee to make it, and you have to take your pick, which you prefer.
Yeah, and in Taiwan, I might just add that on the smart card, there is an area where you can say, you can choose, do not resuscitate.
Yeah.
So then that's respected.
Is there a question on this side? Yes.
Yes. Hi. My name is Bill Emmett, and I'm with the Campaign for Mental Health Reform. The World Health Organization identifies mental disorders as one of the top causes of disability worldwide. Yet in this country, we still can't seem to agree that mental illnesses need to be covered by typical health insurance. What have you found in other countries, and specifically, how is that addressed in Taiwan as the system is being developed?
May, do you want to start, and then Tom?
Sure. The NHI does pay for mental health conditions, both inpatient and outpatient care. But that is one of the areas where there is shortage of mental health beds. And this is, we have been recommending that if they manage to increase funding, that part of the money go to address that area specifically.
I'm a reporter, you know, I had a checklist of questions every country I went to, and one of them is, do you cover mental health? And every country said to me, that's part of health. That's part of medicine. We cover broken legs, and we cover mental health problems, too. So most of the countries appear to be doing a pretty good job on it. The one place that I know fairly well that doesn't have that much is Japan, but I think that's a cultural thing. If you're depressed or you have a mental health problem, you and your family are supposed to work it out. They're just not quite as inclined to go to a psychiatrist or psychologist. But all the countries cover it. It's just part of the package.
May, why is there a shortage of mental health beds? Is it trace back to the way the system is constructed, or?
I think part of that is also cultural, that you tend to keep it in the family. It's not made public. Mm-hmm. And so in the days before the insurance, of course, you keep your mentally ill with you. And so it's never been a sort of a focus or an important part of the healthcare system. But they're aware of this shortage. And I'm very glad to say that the new president-elect, Mr. Ma Ying-jeou, he has proclaimed several months ago, last November, that if he were elected president, he is going to take spending from the current 6.2% to about 7.5%. So there I do agree with Tom that I think Taiwan system is a little bit underfunded. Because if you compare Taiwan spending with the OECD spending, the U.S., of course, is way up there in the sky, right? But Taiwan is way down there at the very bottom. So relative to its economic capability, it could afford to spend more, could afford to spend 7.5% to 8%, but it's currently not.
Actually, she's very modest. She had that in her paper 4 years ago, exactly that number, 7.5%. So he must have read her paper.
A question back here.
Kei Nakagawa, Congressional Budget Office. Since moving to smart cards in Taiwan, it seems like you have a pretty good health information technology infrastructure. Could you talk about whether HIT has led to overall costs or savings, including kind of the general infrastructure development costs of creating all those smart cards and having everybody have the right computers to read all those cards, to all the preventing adverse drug offense and all those things that could lead to cost savings? And if you could also touch upon kind of the privacy concerns and how you overcome some of the privacy threats of having a centralized database of all the health information. Thanks.
Yeah, great question.
Good question.
Yeah. Taiwan's IT system is very powerful indeed. And so the quick answer to your question is yes, it definitely helps control and contain cost because the behavior of both the patient and the provider are crystallized, okay? I, as a patient, the minute I go to a doctor or a hospital, I take out my card, they swipe it. So the Bureau of National Health Insurance, the single payer, knows I'm in. I'm doing something. I'm seeking some kind of care. And then the provider would take his card, the provider card, and swipe it. So immediately the government knows, all right, so this patient is seeing this doctor at this time. And then, of course, if it wants to know, it will know the diagnosis from the claims submitted. The government requires that every 24 hours, all the providers submit to the payer every piece of service delivered so that the government knows on a daily basis how much expenditure has been incurred. And if something looks not right, they say, well, is there an epidemic happening or is there or somebody is something is happening? They know it right away. See, they say that the government knows on a daily basis who is in what bed in what hospital. Or the government knows, or the single payer knows. The government does not know. The single payer knows who's missing which tooth, or what tooth has been filled or crowned. So they have very, very detailed information so they can monitor utilization very closely. And then for expensive high-tech procedures like CTs and MRIs, there are utilization rules. Say, you know, within 90 days, if you need to do repeat MRI, you need pre-authorization. And if you didn't do that, there will be penalties. So it's the IT is what enables Taiwan's NHI to be as efficient as it is in both the cost containment, overall management of resources, and I would mention also in overall quality control, because they see the provider's behavior, what it does. So I go there for an URI, and I submit claims. The BNHI will see, say, this that if it's a simple URI, a cold, if you prescribe antibiotics that are not appropriate, it picks it up, right? And then it'll say, why did you do this? What were the reasons? And if you cannot justify it, you don't get paid or you get reduced payment for that visit.
Tom, when you were reporting in Taiwan, did you hear any complaints or concerns about issues of confidentiality related to all this technology can do?
Only for me. It bothered me. Nobody in Taiwan complained. Same in France, you know. In France, everybody has this green card. I think a lot of people, you know, healthy people just put it in the drawer and can't find it when they get sick. But a lot of people carry it everywhere. Mm-hmm. On the back of the carte vitale in France, it says, if you find this on the street, drop it in the mailbox and we'll return it. And I went down to the office of Carte Perdue or something, the lost card office, and about a little under 1% of the people, 500,000 cards a year are returned. But, you know, the guy who picks up my card on the street theoretically could figure out which shrink I'm seeing and when I had syphilis and all that stuff, you know. And I didn't like that, but I didn't hear that concern in other mm-hmm. countries. They're not as worried about privacy as we, is that it?
But he probably couldn't get into your card.
Well, if his dad's a doctor, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, you're right. It should be coded.
Probably be not so
a
easy.
A question on this side.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jonathan Cohn, a journalist from the New Republic and a former Kaiser Fellow. And I want to say about it, I got to see in advance a media copy of the documentary. It's terrific, really wonderful, so congratulations. My question is about American politics in relation to what you talked about. As you know, in the mainstream political conversation, there's a consensus emerging among this model. You can call it the Massachusetts model, where you require people to obtain insurance mostly from private insurance companies. And oftentimes, people will cite Switzerland as an example of a country that has done this successfully. They'll also talk about the Dutch system. But one key difference which you talk about in the documentary is that in those countries, the insurers cannot make a profit on the insurance of basic services. And that's a more, you know, in fact, in the German system where you have competing insurers, they're not making sickness funds, they're not making a profit on that. And I'm curious whether you think, is this compatible? Can you make a system like that work with for-profit insurance companies competing, or is this a square peg into a round hole?
Well, my answer would be I look all over the world for a country that makes health insurance work and lets the insurers make a profit, and there aren't any. No other country lets them make a profit. In theory, in the Netherlands, which is using Alan Enthoven's system, in theory they could make a profit, but the rates are so low that they can't. Switzerland outlawed profit for basic health care. That was part of their reform. Germany, no profit. Japan, no profit. France, no profit. No, there's no country that's made it work. We do have for-profit health insurance, but I wouldn't say it's working. We have a lot of people who don't get any care. We get a million denied claims. The other countries have decided that for-profit health insurance is just not compatible with taking care of people. If you have to pay a dividend to your stockholders, then you have a very strong interest in not covering anybody who's sick. So you turn down tens of millions of people who want coverage, and you turn down claims like crazy. It's cheaper to have an army of underwriters denying claims than to pay them. And the other countries just don't allow that. In fact, in Switzerland, now the insurance companies promise to pay every claim within 5 days, and if they don't, your next month's premium is free. In other words, what I learned is health insurance doesn't have to be cruel, but to get to that point, you've got to take profit out of the mix. And then the corollary is everybody has to buy insurance, so the insurer has a big enough pool of people that the system works out fine. And then the third point is somebody has to control the pricing for the providers, and the providers have to live with that. If you put those three rules in place, what's called guaranteed issue, everybody gets insurance, every claim is paid, everybody has to buy insurance, and there's some limit on pricing, then you can make private health care work at a reasonable price for everybody.
Can you take the round hole square peg?
Well, the profit per se is really not that much of an issue. If you look at the Medicaid managed care, these are for-profit HMOs who deal focused only on Medicaid, their margin is about 3%. Most Catholic hospitals would be upset if they earned only 3% profit, or most nonprofits would consider 3% too low. So it's not that. what is the reason that works, Medicaid and managed care, because they're very tightly regulated. They're held to quality standards. In some Texas, for example, they have to share the profit. If they make too much, they pay back to the state. What is troublesome the way we do insurance is that every insurer tries to get bargains from doctors and hospitals, shifting the cost to someone else. I asked a New Jersey insurer the other day, what do you pay for a colonoscopy? And he said, what do you mean? We pay many different prices.
Yeah.
And he sent me this long email, and he said, every hospital gets a different fee from us for the same colonoscopy, but a given hospital may also get five different fees, depending whether it's an HMO contract from us or a PPO contract from us. So it's just a huge mess. And then the hospitals say, well, we have to charge the uninsured, because the limo driver, in A1, you've probably taken
it,
he said, I had an emergency, our boy had pus in his eye, and they charged me $1,200 for an emergency room visit. And if you go to the hospital, they say, well, yeah, but Medicaid underpays us, the HMOs squeeze us, we got to get our margin from somewhere, and says, so you discover the uninsured waitress is your tax base. That is what is really so wrong with our insurance system. My rule, I chaired a commission in New Jersey, was very simple. No hospital can charge an uninsured more than Medicare rates. That's it. You get Medicare, thank God, you're lucky. And that's it. You cannot charge more. We'll see if the governor has the courage to follow on that recommendation. I'm really going to hold him to it to say, could you pass at least a law that a waitress doesn't pay more than Medicare to a hospital? We cannot get that done in America. That is what really is wrong with our private insurance system and our private hospital system.
The flip side of the colonoscopy example in the documentary is the anecdote you tell in Japan, where prices are so regulated for what doctors can charge down to the size of a wound.
Yeah, he gets a fee. The fee, they have this phone book-sized book that tells the fee. There's a fee for a surgery for six stitches here. There's a different fee for six stitches here, but it's set. It's the same price everywhere in Japan. And as he says in the documentary, a guy badly cuts his hand. He runs into the doctor, and the doctor gives him six stitches on the back of his hand. The fee for that is $4.30. That's how you control costs.
There's a question right here. Karen, right here.
Alan Gold from Results Educational Fund. I happen to be on Medicare, which I guess is a social insurance system where all of us over 65, I believe we all have at least Part A. And my only concern is that if I had to move, I might have a hard time finding a doctor who's still taking Medicare patients. But that's a matter of what the reimbursement rate is. So it's... It strikes me that Medicare would be a good model for a system covering everybody. Sounds like it's really pretty similar to what you're describing in Europe and elsewhere.
I like that notion of you don't even have to have Medicare as the only one. You just offer Medicare as an alternative. People can still buy from Aetna or WellPoint if they want to, but here's a thought. Let Americans of any age buy Medicare if they want to. If they did, it's cheaper, isn't it?
Yeah.
Either everybody would switch to Medicare or Aetna would have to lower its prices significantly to keep its business base. It's an interesting...
Both Democratic candidates have that?
Yeah, and they don't talk about it.
Hillary Clinton does.
Footnote 68 of the plan. But if you go way back to the end of the plan, they say, by the way, anybody who can find an adequate health insurance plan can buy Medicare. But if that happened, in 2 years, everybody would be on Medicare, or prices for the private plans would fall dramatically to compete.
Yes.
I'm Andrew Bearer. I currently direct a global health advocacy program for the Gates Foundation. But I used to be the chairman of the University of Wisconsin Hospital and president of our HMO. And This morning I attended a program that the director of the Congressional Budget Office spoke at, and he mentioned his analysis through an expert group of panels is that about one-third of our health care expenditures are sort of attributable to waste, inefficiency, a little bit of it fraud and abuse, but that's an incredible amount. It interprets to 5% of our GDP, overall GDP. But that instead of looking necessarily to other countries, he was on a panel with someone from the Netherlands and someone from Switzerland, we could look to regions of the country, of the U.S., where there is efficient, cost-effective health care. And he gave one example, sort of an extreme example, was that the cost at Mayo Clinic was half the cost at UCLA Medical Center. And that there are, you know, many pockets in the U.S. And I'd like, especially Professor Reinhardt, to comment on that system about when we look at the U.S., we're always looking at the sort of overall average, but are there systems and locations within the U.S. where there is cost-effective health care and there are good models that we could replicate around the country?
I mean, that is certainly true. The intra-U.S. variation in per capita health spending actually exceeds the across-nation variation in per capita health spending. Those are the famous Wenberg variations, as they're called, because Jack Wenberg at Dartmouth and his associates have told us about that for probably 25 years. The first article I recall was American Scientific, John Wenberg and Adam Gidelson. And they have shown this consistently, and then they linked it to, does that matter as to outcome? Does it matter as to patient satisfaction? Or the process, the clinical process, the quality of that? And it turns out it has no correlation. The interesting thing is that he has testified, I have done it, many people have testified before Congress, and the following can be said. United States Congress has absolutely no interest in reducing obviously, evidently dubious Medicare expenditures. Let me repeat that. The United States Congress has no interest whatsoever in reducing dubious Medicare expenditures. Why? They have known this for 25 years. To my knowledge, they haven't even funded a study to figure out what goes on. Because what Jack Wenberg says, if people everywhere, if doctors everywhere in the U.S. could be taught to practice medicine like Intermountain Healthcare or like Mayo Clinic or like even the hospital Sutter Sacramento, we could save 30% of all Medicare spending. That's what they have calculated. So the interesting and intriguing question for journalists, too, why is the Congress so disinterested in cost containment when it constantly whines about having to restructure Medicare? That is, to me, a huge mystery. Once it testified, and I asked Senator Roth, as a taxpayer, don't you think you owe me an explanation for this? You know, you're spending my money here. And the staff has pulled me aside and said, Jesus, how could you bring that up in this blunt way? And he said, you were looking at the senator from Florida. And they said, did you know you were? And I said, yeah, that's exactly why I did look at him, because in Dade County, they're one of the highest spending. They spend almost three times as much per elderly, same elderly, as they do at the Mayo Clinic.
Well, what do you make of some of the CMS efforts during the Bush administration, particularly when Mark McClellan was in office, for about getting at cost containment?
No, he didn't address that issue. He just addressed issues of quality. He was trying to get pay for performance. Mm-hmm. But the proposals we had when I served on Physician Payment Review Commission, some of us commissioners said, you know, we ought to cap the states. Tell Florida, this is all you're going to get. We're not going to let yours go up, and we're going to let Minnesota's go up gradually, because somehow you should learn how to practice more efficient Medicare. But within the state of New Jersey, the amount of Medicare spending for patients in the last 2 years of their life varies by hospital region by a factor of three. In northern New Jersey, it costs three times as much to die than in southern New Jersey. And if you ask the hospital executives, can you explain to me what goes on? You need to give them a scotch or two. They'll say, you know, it's the doctors. We cannot control the doctors. We have a free workshop for the doctors. They walk in here. They can do whatever they like. We've got to pay for it. And we don't have any power to tell a doctor not to do it, because if we anger them, they go and take their business to the next hospital, and we're losing revenue. So ultimately, the government has to control it. I conclude, yeah, one more government control. You guys couldn't do it. We gave you the field. You couldn't handle it. Just like mothers and teenagers. You give them a little rope. If they mess up, mothers will control them. And I think the government has to control the hospitals better.
Yes, up here.
Hi, I'm Rainey Ernst, and I'm senior producer of PBS Frontline. I worked with Tom on this documentary. I had a question for Professor Reinhart. When we were looking, actually, at this film, we did look internationally, obviously, and one of the things that we were contemplating is whether we could come back to the United States and do a sort of comparative analysis looking at the state of Massachusetts. What I'm curious is, if you've looked at that state, what you think of it, if you think that we're at a point now where we know whether or not that's been successful as an experiment here.
The structure of it, although it is complicated, is sort of an American structure that could work, because everyone gets a little, everyone contributes a little. And it could be made to work. And, of course, Senator Clinton's plan is Massachusetts writ large, and so was Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the interesting thing about Massachusetts was that it was crafted by policy wonks from the Urban Institute and the Heritage Foundation working together, which shows that's probably the way in this country to go. Given alternatives like Medicare for All, although attractive, probably politically wouldn't fly. The problem with Massachusetts, and many of us said it as it was passed, is there wasn't enough funding. And we rather suspect that Governor Romney knew that, and everyone else knew it. You just had to get the nose under the tent, and then eventually you would have to spend more money. And yesterday, I think they're about $100 million short up there. But if they put that money in there, it would work. It would absolutely work. It's really a question of money. Now, Massachusetts has a plus and a minus. The plus is they have fairly few uninsured, something like 10% uninsured, and they are a high-income state. The bad part of it, they're also unbelievably expensive health care because of all their academic health centers. Now, if you go to Louisiana, 25% uninsured, low-income state, and actually not cheap health care either for some reason. So Louisiana, this could only work if the feds put in a lot of subsidy, a lot.
Did either one of you want to add anything to that? No. Okay. Right here.
Hi, I'm Bianca Frogner. I'm a student at Johns Hopkins Public Health School. I have a question about, I study healthcare expenditures in my own work and how we spend our money. A lot of times I get that a lot of people in America feel that part of why we spend so much money is that we have some of the best doctors, not necessarily the best healthcare system, but the best doctors. And I'm kind of curious to know the impression you got from people in other countries about whether or not they had access to the best doctors within their own country or whether or not they felt like they had to come to America to actually get that best care. One anecdote to this is my cousin in Norway had to have heart surgery at a young age, and he came to America to see the best heart specialist. And then Norway reimbursed all the costs associated with that surgery. But if I tell the story to an American, they get very angry, the fact that we trained those doctors and are actually footing the bill, too, in some ways. So just curious about your impressions.
Tom?
Well, Arab sheikhs fly to the Mayo Clinic or to Johns Hopkins to be treated. So clearly they've identified the place where they think they can get the best care. I don't have any question whatsoever that we have, you can get the best care from the best doctor in the best hospital in the world in the United States. It's just that a lot of people can't get it in the United States is the problem. Rates of satisfaction, if you survey people, are you happy with the healthcare system? All the countries I went to have higher rates of satisfaction than we do. So most people there seem to think that they're getting pretty decent care. We talked to a lot of people in the film, if you have time to see the film, in every country, I think I say, what do you think about healthcare here? And, fine, we're, you know. A Japanese woman is off stuff to say, I've never had healthcare in any other country, so how would I know? But And we talked to a German, who, an American, I'm sorry, who's running a bar in Berlin about he compares American and German healthcare. But people seem satisfied, and maybe satisfied in other countries, more satisfied than in America, but their prices are lower, and they have universal access, which we don't.
Jim? Final question from the audience.
On this issue with physicians, I cannot imagine that another country educates and trains, and those are two things, mm-hmm. both educate and train doctors better than we do. I think it is an awesome enterprise the way we do it, and most of our doctors are very good. Interesting, though, when you go to London or to Germany, you also see a lot of Arab sheikhs. So they go there, too.
Yes. Yeah.
And it is probably true if you really want heroic medicine or sort of when all your hope is gone, America still has it. There's no question about that our doctors are good. There's no question either that they should be well paid, and many of them should be better paid than they are, particularly when you see what their classmates do on Wall Street.
Yes.
Right? You have to realize that, too. I always tell my students, those of you who go to Goldman Sachs might not have got into medical school, but those of you who go to medical school all could go to Goldman Sachs, and they'd be happy to have you. So I think one has to leave that to the American medical profession. They're good. I don't know what you would say relative to Taiwan.
I think, although I like to call attention to this RAND study in 2003 on the quality of care, that in America, an average American receives the appropriate kind of care only 55% of the time, whether that care is preventive or for acute or chronic. So to me, that is not a very great number, although I do agree with both Tom and Uwe that you know, we do have probably among the best physicians and medical centers. But on average, 55% is not, to me, a great number for what we spend. We're spending over 16% GDP.
Mm-hmm. You've seen these studies from the Commonwealth Institute where they cover?
I'm very familiar with the quality of care overall might not be so...
I think it's the most stunning thing I've found in the whole 2 years is that other countries have better health results than the United States. How could that be? But it's true.
There was a study on... sonar for babies.
Yeah.
And it turns out, it's called Eurofetus study, that they're cheaper, sonar scans, cheaper in Europe and better, more accurate, and better read. Yeah. And a radiologist at Harvard said the reason is that in Europe you have to get it done in a hospital by specially trained specialists, not even doctors who do the scan. In the U.S., every doctor can do it in their office. And most of them are not well trained for that. They're very well trained for many other things, but not for this sort of thing. So actually, we spend more and get less because of the way we organize it. Not so much that our doctors are not trained well for what they are supposed to do, which is not running sonar scans. You know.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble seeing past these bright lights. There's a question back here.
I've got one here, actually.
Okay,
I'm Dan Waldo. I work for a large social semi-insurance company here in town. And it seems to me from looking at these various health systems that they work best when there's a good sense of social solidarity. Mm-hmm. And that's something in the United States. My perception is more we work on social fragmentation than social solidarity. So my question is, if we are going to reform our system, how do we overcome the sense of social fragmentation, or how do we instill a sense of social solidarity that will at least last long enough for us to get a new insurance system underway?
I think we've come full circle. It's kind of what we were talking about in the beginning.
Yes.
Do you want to take that one, Uwe?
Yeah, I'll start and hope my colleagues will pitch in. I gave a talk at the National Academy for Social Insurance, and my closing slide was, what kind of country are we? Are we a nation, or are we just a group of people sharing a geography? And I have lived in two nations. Germany, I grew up, it's a nation. You sense it when you're there. So, and Canada. I'm still a Canadian as well. Well, there's a sense, really, you know, when you're Canadian, you know that. You're a Canadian. And what made me, what my slide said is, having observed how we treated this war, I'm beginning to think we're not a nation. And I'm actually having a debate on Princeton campus with students over this. Look at how you behave. You write these right-wing tracts, we should do Iran, we should stand firm in Iraq, but you don't serve. And others have to go for the fourth time over there. You're not patriots. And I feel offended by so many people who have the U.S. flag in their lapel but have done nothing to support this war, either with taxes. Our son fought there without a flak jacket. And I won't forgive the American people ever for sending him there in an advanced armored column without a flak jacket. But you did this. And because it's not a nation, he was sent there with an unarmored Humvee. He was sent there with the wrong gun. I mean, you know, May and I suffered a lot from the inadequate equipment of that boy when he went over there because we had to have tax cuts. That was the idea of sacrifice. Tax cuts and go shopping. And, you know, these soldiers can fend on their own. So a nation or a country that treats its wars and its soldiers that way, would you expect it to develop social solidarity, Dan, over health insurance? And I had to say, I don't think so. I don't think it'll come.
May. Social solidarity, when it always comes to mind the case of the unification between East and West Germany. So they came together, I think it was 1989. Mm-hmm. The wall came down and they proceeded to reunite. And the West German government paid all the bills. And to share as a nation, to reunite with the other part of your old country, every German taxpayer is assessed a head tax. So I forget what the percentage is. 1%?
Yeah.
And so that everyone participates in the nation building of post-communist East Germany, whereas here we're in Iraq, we're in Afghanistan. But take the Iraq War. The Americans were not asked to pay any price in terms of taxes, or what have we been asked to do? Would we say just go continue your shopping, go on doing whatever you do. So there's no sacrifice, personal sacrifice, that any one of us have been asked to make, other than those families who have loved ones out there in the boots fighting on the ground there. And it puzzles me. So I guess that's a very indirect way to answer your question. I don't think it's, I think it's a very, very big challenge for this country. It'll stand in the way of a lot of the really social, important social programs that we need. I was very impressed. I was in China last month and met with the Minister of Health there, who told me that in China, the government views healthcare as a right. Ooh. So even though the health insurance health coverage is very expensive, very difficult. What coverage they have is very shallow for the majority of the people, but the government has stated its objective. That is healthcare for all. Healthcare is a right. But have you heard of such statements in this country?
Yeah, I'm more optimistic than either of these two. I think we are likely to change our healthcare system arguably next year, and I think the compelling argument is going to be this moral argument. We don't want to let tens of thousands of our fellow Americans go bankrupt and thousands of our fellow Americans die because they can't see a doctor, and because we don't want to do that, because we're all in this country together, I think we're going to fix it.
I hope so. But wait till you get emails after this, the kind I get. I'm often shocked what people will write down.
And in the last question, in the 9 countries you visited, was it, when you talk to people, was it framed more frequently in terms of the moral imperative versus the fiscal arguments?
Yeah, you'll see this in our movie, too. Everybody we talk to, how do you like your health care system? And the first thing I say is, well, anybody can see a doctor. That's really important. Everybody feels that's important. And that moral sense that if any of our friends or neighbors get sick, we ought to make sure they can see a doctor, that's a powerful force in all these countries. I think it can be a powerful force here. If we can get over this notion that anybody that's sick can go in the emergency ward and get treated free, which is not true, but you know, some Americans say that. If we can convince people that's not true, and it's not true, I think people will fix it when they realize, A, that the system's pretty bad, and B, that it's fixable without fundamentally un-American approaches.
Final word. Thank you all so much. It was a fascinating conversation.
Some Americans say, you mean George
Thank
Bush.
Thank all of you.
The president. Yeah.
Well, thank you all for joining us, and especially to my colleague Penny Duckham, who put this together.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks. So you're actually optimistic.
Great.